Welcome to Wild Utah, the podcast of the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance. I'm Dave Pacheco. Listeners of this podcast are familiar with SUA's work to stop the Bureau of Land Management from conducting vegetation treatment projects. We prefer to use the more accurate term, vegetation removal. We've previously highlighted this practice of clear-cutting mostly healthy pinyon juniper forests in the name of habitat restoration. In previous episodes, we pulled off the thin veil, revealing a practice that mostly benefits public land domestic livestock grazers. SUA Wildlands attorney Kaya Marienfeld has worked on a new report titled The Bureau of Land Management's Vegetation Removal Program, Moving Backward on Climate and 30 by 30, to help more deeply explain the broader impact of this ecologically destructive activity. Thanks for joining us, Kaya.
Hi, Dave. Thanks for having me on once again. Happy to discuss it.
So, you know, let's start with the basics. For those who may be new to the subject, explain just what is a vegetation removal project.
Yeah, absolutely. So as a quick review, I know we've talked about this several times on the podcast before, but vegetation removal, also called vegetation treatment, habitat restoration, watershed enhancement, sometimes rangeland restoration, if it's coming from the agency, takes a ton of forms, really. So at the most basic level, the Bureau of Land Management or the Forest Service in some instances uses chainsaws to cut down pinyon, pine, and juniper trees, herbicides to kill sagebrush or pinyon and juniper saplings, and prescribe fire to remove those same tree saplings and shrubs. But more commonly, and the method we're really concerned with here, is when the BLM uses destructive heavy machinery to kill native vegetation. And this can be bull hog masticators that really quickly turn entire forests into wood chips, or chaining, which uses a large anchor chain dragged between two bulldozers to really tear everything out of its path out of the ground. This rakes the ground and destroys the surface and the soil crusts that are on it.
Okay, so let's focus in on that. Explain what the problem with doing this sort of practice is as a matter of soil disturbance. Dive into that.
Bringing heavy equipment in to remove vegetation on what otherwise is a functioning ecosystem with pinyon pine and juniper trees or sagebrush or some of the other native plant life we see on the Colorado Plateau here is critical and really harmful here in particular, I think, more so than other places, because here on the Colorado Plateau and in the Great Basin, so all the lands we seek to protect with America's Red Rock Wilderness Act, the topsoil is held together by cryptobiotic soil. So this cryptobiotic soil, which is also called biological soil crust or biocrust for short, it's formed by living microbiotic organisms. And those living microbiotic organisms sort of band together to create this really interesting structure that, you know, it covers more of 70% of the living ground in the arid Southwest. And it plays not just a critical role in the ecosystem, but really the role for everything else that survived there. So it captures rainwater, it prevents erosion, and it even gives those plants, those native plants that we're concerned about, a place to grow in the first place. You know, without it, most of our desert plants would have nothing to even hold on to, and it would just be, you know, a constant sea of dunes everywhere where there's sort of the sandy desert soils underneath. So in addition to being that backbone of the whole desert ecosystem, these biocrusts, they also directly mitigate climate change. So we normally think of tropical or temperate rainforests or that northern taiga forest up in Canada and Russia as having high potential to store carbon that contributes to climate change when it's released. But these dry land ecosystems, which cover about 47% of the whole land area in the world, also act as an important carbon sink, thanks, for example, to those biocrusts, which science is showing increasingly store a significant amount of carbon as well. Studies show that carbon storage in those desert sinks is the highest where those soils and vegetation remain undisturbed in the first place. And to the same end, the lowest where the soils are disturbed or destroyed altogether, which is a really common outcome after vegetation removal projects that use that heavy machinery like chaining or mastication. You know, removing these biocrusts also directly results in desertification of what was once a healthy native plant community, because even immediately reseeding an area that's been chained or masticated with that heavy machinery doesn't prevent erosion or desertification, because that cryptobiotic soil takes decades and decades to grow back. So once it's gone for a long time, and there's a lot of those really quick processes like desertification that can come in and happen.
You know, as you're explaining that, Kaya, it makes a lot more sense now. For 20, 30 years, the public land agencies, groups like Leave No Trace, other educators have been really attempting to get people who visit these places to be aware of the cryptobiotic soil, just to not even walk on it for the disturbance that it would cause. And it just puts it in perspective here of what the agency is doing out of the other side of its mouth, which is allowing this large-scale, industrial-size destruction of these soils. And it just really is, it's worth mentioning that we're really doing the harm ourselves, and we just don't even know to what extent the BLM is allowing this sort of activity. And to talk about it in terms of its impact on climate really brings us to a different level.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you get a ticket for going off trail in a lot of places, whether on your feet or in a vehicle or on a bicycle, because of the really quick and really irreparable harm that can happen to those desert soil crusts in a lot of areas like national parks or conservation lands for the BLM. And yet there's times when the agency themselves are driving what's not essentially, it's literally a bulldozer across it. And if you can imagine the type of impact a human footprint leaves compared to the type of impact that a bulldozer or a big industrial truck or a front end loader has on that same crust, it's pretty stark contrast.
Yeah, so let's talk about that. What exactly happens? So when you have this mechanical destruction and these large-scale impacts of the soil, explain what happens to that soil once it's impacted to that large degree. I know in some ways you can, you know, boil it down to a concept we call red dust on snow. Scientists have studied this for a long time, but explain exactly what happens there and what the problem is that results from these airborne red soils going to other places.
So as we just talked about, removing those soil crusts, that is the topsoil. You know, there's not really actual topsoil in the conventional understanding of the word here in the arid Southwest and these dry land ecosystems. So when you get rid of those soil crusts that hold the entire ecosystem together, this results in a process called desertification, which is when the soil health, native vegetation, and the moisture are diminished to an extent that they don't come back in the same way that they've existed. And this happens most often in places disturbed by machinery. You know, this is in the Colorado Plateau. This is oil and gas fields. This is really heavily utilized off-road vehicle play areas. And it's also areas that have been the subject of some sort of vegetation treatment or vegetation removal by one of those surface disturbing methods. So this turns a lot of what was functioning soil, a functioning ecosystem with vegetation able to grow in it and water recapture, into the sand and dust that's really underneath everything. And then that becomes airborne. Wind is another really incredible major factor in the Southwest. It's the reason we have arches. You know, it's the reason we have all these incredible geologic features that people come here to see, is because of wind erosion. So that very same wind erosion makes that dust airborne. And here on the Colorado Plateau, windstorms pick up those desert soils that have been disturbed by activities like vegetation removal or development. And then those same airborne dusts are deposited eastward on the mountain snowpack throughout the Rocky Mountains. Here in sort of the southeast part of Utah where I am, we see some really recent and really great studies showing that dust from our area goes directly to the San Juan Mountains in the southern Rockies. And when this dark dust lands on the snow, it causes increased absorption of solar rays. So it's like wearing a dark t-shirt outside on a hot day. You absorb a lot more sun if you're wearing black than you do if you're wearing white or a lighter color. So this causes the snow to melt much faster and much sooner than it normally was. And unfortunately, studies are already showing that these disturbed desert soils landing on the mountain snowpack throughout the Colorado River Basin in particular has resulted in a net loss, I think, of 5% of the annual flow of the Colorado River every year. This is a huge number, and it's something that, you know, this is a really stark impact of climate change that we're seeing throughout the West.
Well, yeah. I mean, the everybody knows that the Colorado River is such a significant part of the American Southwest. There's something like 40 million people, 12% of the American population that depends on the Colorado River. Am I getting that right?
Yeah, it's 40 million people and increasing every day. I think, you know, that the move westward is something that's still continuing to happen. We're talking about the whole Colorado River. We're not just talking about Colorado, to be clear, or the Rockies. This feeds the Four Corners. This feeds Arizona, New Mexico, Utah, Southern California in particular. I think the other thing, apart just from 40 million people relying on this water, it's 15% of the nation's agriculture. So this is parts of Southern California, which is part of the agriculture industry for the country. And that's where all the irrigation water comes from.
It's so interesting to hear it all tied together like that. So if you can wrap this all up nicely for us here, Kaya, how does stopping vegetation removal on these intact wilderness quality lands directly help us address the problem of climate change?
It leaves intact lands in their natural state, which we know is a great idea for a lot of reasons. It's habitat for native wildlife. It's connectivity corridors. It's places that are a little bit more resilient as we're seeing the nations and the world's climate continue to shift in ways that humans and the species that we coexist with are going to have to respond and adapt to that. But it essentially gives those dry land ecosystems we're talking about their best chance to thrive and survive undisturbed by heavy machinery and vegetation loss, which really helps them resist that desertification we were talking about. So that slows the climate forcing processes like the dust on snow phenomenon we discussed. You know, that's been ravaging the health of Western watersheds like the Colorado River Basin already. And if we ramp that up, you know, that obviously continues to have a huge effect. But it not only slows the processes that are causing climate change if you leave these native Western ecosystems, these native plants, these native biological soil crusts intact, but it also actually helps contribute to countering climate change by protecting those carbon sinks we were talking about. So that's the biological soil crust that scientists are showing increasingly store a significant amount of carbon, so much that, you know, we can protect all the rainforests and all the northern forests we want to, but we're going to have other pieces of the puzzle. And science is really showing that those dry land ecosystems, which you wouldn't really think of as major carbon sinks off the top of your head, are a huge part of that. We're going to have to really significantly look at protecting those ecosystems and their ability to store climate as well. So that's the biological soil crust, which because of its natural processes, stores a ton of carbon when it's in really good shape and really intact and really old, which healthy biocrust is. And that's also the vegetation that lives on those biocrusts. That's pinyon pine and juniper forests. Those are really significant carbon sinks too. Shrublands as well. Those shrublands and forests store a lot more carbon alone than grasslands do, which is essentially what, even if a vegetation removal project is successful, you're seeing a lot of transition from forest into grassland. That's sort of the point of a lot of them. You want more forage for livestock. You want more grass and forb species, and those just aren't as big of a carbon sink as the forests and the healthy biocrusts are. So, you know, these are important scientific conclusions, and they're a significant piece of the puzzle when it comes to stopping, slowing, and then even reversing climate change.
Well, you certainly always leave us with plenty of information to contemplate. We really appreciate you taking the time to fill us in on this new report, Kaya. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks, Dave. Always happy to be on.
Yeah, and again, you can find the Bureau of Land Management's Vegetation Removal Program, Moving Backward on Climate and 30 by 30, at SUA.org. Click the Issues tab and select Chaining and Vegetation Removal or Climate and 30 by 30. We'll have it in both places. Wild Utah is recorded at SUA's main office in Salt Lake City on equipment purchased through the generosity of our members. SUA is primarily member-funded. Over 90% of our revenue comes directly from individuals who care about protecting Southern Utah's Red Rock Country. We're proud of that because it keeps our voice independent. If you'd like to help protect Wild Utah today, please head to SUA.org and click the Donate button. We appreciate your support. Wild Utah's theme music, What's Worth, is composed by Moab singer-songwriter Haley Noel Austin. Post-studio production and editing is by Jerry Schmidt. To stay informed about current events at SUA, visit us at SUA.org and click on Get Involved to discover how you can join the movement to protect Wild Utah. To receive information and alerts via text message, text the word Utah to 52886. That's the word Utah to the number 52886. Follow the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance on Facebook, on Instagram, at Protect Wild Utah, and on Twitter, at Southern UT Wild. And be sure to subscribe to the Wild Utah podcast on Spotify, iTunes, or your favorite podcast app. Visit SUA.org/podcast for additional ways to subscribe and to access our archive of previous episodes. On behalf of SUA, I'm Dave Pacheco. Thanks for taking the time to listen. We hope you can join us for the next episode of Wild Utah.